This is HBR 2947 for Tuesday, the 19th of November 2019. Today's show is entitled The Mimblewimble Protocol and is hosted by Might Be Mike. It's about 21 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is Mimblewimble is a new blockchain protocol for scalability, privacy, and fungibility.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Welcome back to Hacker Public Radio. This is Might Be Mike, here with another blockchain episode about Mimblewimble. It sounds like a tongue twister, and it is. Mimblewimble is actually from Harry Potter. I believe this is the spell to tie people's tongues to prevent them from divulging secrets. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong about this stuff. I'm not very knowledgeable about Harry Potter, and Mimblewimble is full of Harry Potter references. So, really, Mimblewimble protocol is all about scalability, privacy, and fungibility. This is a protocol for blockchains that scale elegantly and provide privacy by default using strong cryptographic primitives. Now, Mimblewimble started in August 2016 when some unknown person named Tom Elvis Jedusor, which is actually the French name for Voldemort, the bad guy in the Harry Potter series, anonymously shows up and drops a link to a white paper that describes this protocol. There's a mathematician at Blockstream named Andrew Polstra, who was one of the first people to review it. He goes in and corrects errors, formalizes it, and publishes it as a white paper a couple months later. And then yet another anonymous character, Ignotus Perivel, which I don't know who that is. He's something to do with Harry Potter, though. Somebody's brother, perhaps. He appears on that same IRC channel, Bitcoin Wizards, in late October and announced he has a project going, an open source blockchain based on this, which would turn into one of the two blockchains that I think is really interesting in this space, the one called Grin. Now, the interesting thing about Mimblewimble is there's a realization on the part of this anonymous character or characters that the transaction history does not need to be stored. This is a way to get better scalability. You probably know if you join the Bitcoin network as a node, you need to verify the entire blockchain, and it's totally there to be done because the entire transaction history is saved, from the Genesis block all the way to the current. In this case, this character realized we don't need to save that, actually. If we know the coins that were created, and we know the current state of the blockchain, and we have proofs that no funny business took place in between, that's all you need. I think that characterizes the whole spirit of this. Cryptography over complexity. So Mimblewimble provides privacy and fungibility by, first of all, not having any addresses. There are no amounts visible in the transactions or recorded anywhere on the blockchain. The transactions themselves can be aggregated together. They are. And a lot of the inputs and outputs are eliminated along the way. So it's very difficult to build a transaction graph. If you're taking a look at the blockchain from a forensics perspective, there's just nothing to go on. And we'll get into the detail of that shortly. Well, so let's look at the actual structure of the blockchain. You might know already that blockchains represent the state of the system through one of two means primarily. Bitcoin does it with a UTXO set. This is basically telling you where all the coins are right now. So UTXO set is that set of all unspent transaction outputs. That is, all these unspent outputs from previous transactions. Where are they right now? Well, the answer to that question would be a set of addresses in Bitcoin. Here we have no addresses, so it's a little bit trickier. And for completeness sake, let me mention that the other popular technique is that used by Ethereum, which is to keep a hash, basically, of all the addresses and balances. So in Mimblewimble, blocks have only the necessary inputs and outputs taken together in one big transaction. This is a lot like the coin join that Bitcoin people might be familiar with. Bitcoin mixing services commonly use a coin join technique. This is often implemented as a service where a group of people, let's say 10, will all submit a transaction using the same amount for an input, like one Bitcoin. So if I have 10 inputs of one Bitcoin and 10 sets of outputs, they're combined into one transaction, and that makes it more difficult to match up inputs to outputs. So it's not really hiding anything. It's just obfuscating. So you look at a big transaction like that, and you know that the address from which one of the inputs came matches with the address of one of the outputs with a certain probability, in this case, 10%. So anyway, in this system, redundant inputs and outputs are eliminated, but these remainders, called kernels, are still there. These kernels are essentially proofs. At their simplest, I believe they can go down to almost 60 bytes or so. When I'm looking around on the blockchain here, I see they're typically about 100 bytes, which is pretty small. Privacy coins tend to have very large transactions as they add a lot of bulk in their efforts to obfuscate. For example, Monero, probably the best example of a privacy coin out there today. Their transactions are an order of magnitude larger. A transaction might be 1,400 bytes, 1,500 bytes, something like that. And Zcash even larger. It's not a criticism of those systems. Zcash was a real innovator when they started because they got these zero-knowledge proofs called ZK-SNARKs to work. Before that, these were about 100K in size, if I'm not mistaken, and they got them down to about 4K. Still, that's per transaction. Here we're talking about storing just little blobs, inputs, outputs, and kernels that are on the order of about 100 bytes each. So very small. And a lot of the inputs and outputs are eliminated, as I said. So the way that happens is imagine a miner assembling a block. A miner in a Mimblewimble blockchain will take pending transactions from a mempool, just like a normal blockchain, the difference being that they combine them all into a single transaction. When you do that, you notice that some of the outputs are subsequently used as inputs to what used to be subsequent transactions. Now it's later on in the same transaction, and these are redundant and can be thrown away. If you think about this conceptually, imagine Alice sends coins to Bob. Bob sends those coins to Charlie. So what needs to get recorded on the blockchain? The current UTXO set shows Alice has coins, and the next UTXO set is going to reflect the fact that Charlie has the coins. There's no need to record activities that Bob was involved in. So that other important function of eliminating inputs and outputs is called cut-through. So what you have in these transactions is inputs, outputs, and some excess values. Mainly, that's the kernel that I referred to before. And we're going to touch on this in more detail in a little while. The inputs, of course, have no addresses associated with them. Most of you have probably seen a Bitcoin transaction before. It has UTXOs used as inputs. These have addresses with them. It has amounts that are just numbers you can read, and outputs, addresses to which these UTXOs are going. This is where the UTXOs are going to reside in the next state of the system. the new state occurring when another block gets added onto the blockchain each time. So in Mimblewimble transactions, the inputs still reference UTXOs. There's just no addresses. The outputs include hidden values. In other words, there's no amount visible. And this is because of the use of a blinding factor. Now, observers to the blockchain can see obscured inputs and outputs and kernels. None of these disclose any information. They're just blobs that reveal nothing. So an important point here is that miners can validate these transactions without knowing the actual amount being transferred. This is done by a range proof. The range proof operates in the same manner that it does on other blockchains. In Bitcoin, the miner is looking to do two things to validate a transaction. First of all, they want to know that the sender had the right to spend that Bitcoin. And secondly, they want to sum up the inputs and the outputs and make sure the difference is zero. In other words, this transaction does not create any free money out of thin air, and it didn't destroy any coins. So that's pretty straightforward in Bitcoin. You just add up the sums and take the difference. It's just simple arithmetic. Here the amounts are not visible though, so it's a little trickier. In fact, that first step was a little trickier too, making sure the sender had the right to spend that UTXO. In Bitcoin, the miner receives the transaction that's signed by a private key, and that signature can be checked with a public key. And the public key, of course, is where the address comes from. In Bitcoin and other blockchains like Ethereum, addresses are directly derived from those public keys by hashing them. So the miner can validate that the address that corresponds to that public key, which signed the transaction, is the same one that's listed in the UTXO set. So the way that the miners determine that no free money has been created out of thin air is through some fancy math. There are these things called Peterson commitments, which are the building blocks of confidential transactions. This comes out of the confidential transactions work from the Bitcoin OG, Greg Maxwell. Anyway, these Peterson commitments, all the inputs and the outputs look like this. And it's hard to describe in audio without a whiteboard or a picture, but basically they take the form of RG plus VH, where G and H are actually generator points. This is elliptic curve cryptography. So G and H are points on a curve. And the V, remember the second term is VH. That V is actually the UTXO value. This is the amount of the transaction. And you can't tell what it is because of this blinding factor, the first term. Now the RG in this formula, the R is actually a secret key. It's a private key generated by the wallet of the sender in the input and by the receiver in the output. So if you picked up on the nuance in that statement, what might occur to you is that transactions happen very differently here than they do in Bitcoin. In Bitcoin, the sender assembles the transaction and signs it with their private key and throws it over the wall, basically. That's it. It's done. The receiver just looks at some point and it shows up. There's nothing to be done. This is more interactive because both parties need to participate. The sender and the receiver in the transaction need to communicate out of band somehow and transfer information back and forth. For one thing, the sender of the transaction needs to send the value and the blinding factor to the recipient, and the recipient actually needs to send the new blinding factor back. Remember, that blinding factor has an R term in it, which represents the private key, which basically gives them the right to spend it. So the output of the transaction is going to be the next UTXO, and the recipient wants to be the one that has generated that R, that secret key, because they want to have the right to spend that next UTXO. So both parties have to cooperate here. It is asynchronous. They don't have to be engaged at the same time, but at the end of the process, one of them needs to go online and broadcast the transaction. So this formula that is so hard to deal with over an audio format like a podcast, RG plus VH, this is the form, the Peterson commitment, that the inputs and outputs take. And the miner simply adds up all of these inputs, R1G plus V1H, R2G plus V2H, and so on, and adds up all of the outputs and simply takes the difference. Now, if you're following along at home closely, you probably notice that the second half of those terms that have the V, the value, the UTXO value, are going to cancel out, and you're going to be left with the sum of the blinding factors. If that's the case, then no new money was created, and the transaction is valid. Well, not quite. Actually, there's one more complicating factor. And that is, if you can't see the amounts, you do need to be concerned that somebody didn't find a way to pull some funny business. For example, negative numbers. Let's say, just for the sake of example, that I constructed a transaction where I'm sending coins to myself with inputs of 4 and 4 and outputs of minus 2 and 10. I'd send that minus 2 somewhere else and take the 10, including my 2 free coins, if I could get away with it. But there is another mechanism here. There's actually a bulletproof, which is a different kind of zero knowledge proof. We don't need to get into the specifics of distinguishing the various zero knowledge proof types. It's a fascinating field which is changing rapidly at this point, but bulletproof is just a small, very efficient proof, not a big drain on resources, and it's included in the block header, showing that the miner does indeed have this proof that none of the values were negative. So no funny business going on, even though they were not able to see the values. So once again, I know that was tough stuff. G and H in these Peterson commitments are points on the elliptic curve. V is the value being spent. R is a secret key. And the construction of a transaction between the sender and the receiver is an interactive process that requires both get involved. And this has consequences, which we'll see in a few minutes. Of course, as you realize by now, if you look at the blockchain, wow, you're not going to see any amounts. You're not going to see any addresses. So look at this from an adversary's point of view. Look at this from a forensics point of view. If you're trying to build a transaction graph, well, looking at the blockchain, you're not going to get a lot of clues. Amounts would be a big clue, because if I know that Bob receives 3.6502 coins from somebody, I might be able to find a transaction that was generated by somebody for that same amount, that 3.6502. How many people are sending that amount in the transaction? The sender of that transaction is probably who I'm looking for. And eventually I might be able to piece together a transaction graph. So without that capability, probably the good strategy for an adversary is to run a node on the network and watch for transactions before they get to that point. In other words, the miner is assembling a block, taking these transactions, combining them, pruning, throwing away inputs and outputs. And at that point, by the time the block gets appended to the blockchain, there's no clues left to be had. You need to look earlier on than that. So what an adversary really wants to do here is watch the mempool. When the transactions are pending and have not been included in the block yet, none of that pruning has taken place. So all the inputs and outputs are in place. They haven't all been aggregated into one giant transaction, so there's less confusion there and a little bit more to go on. To combat this, the two main blockchains using this protocol are using what is called the Dandelion Protocol. The Dandelion Protocol is used to prevent an observer from seeing who actually generated a transaction, and here's how it works. Normally in Bitcoin, if I generate a transaction, I sign it, and I broadcast it to all my peers. This is the basis of the gossip protocol. All those peers broadcast it to all their peers, and it's available as a pending transaction, hopefully for every miner around that is constructing a block. Here, the goal is to obscure the source of the transaction. So instead of broadcasting a transaction to all the peers, what a node does actually is pick one peer at random and send it to them. And that one peer basically flips a coin, you might say, to determine whether or not they pass it along to a single randomly chosen peer or broadcast it. It might get passed along one by one on several hops, but eventually somebody is going to broadcast it. This is where the name comes from. The first hops along that process are like the stem of a dandelion. And then at some point, one node is going to broadcast it to every peer they have, much like blowing on the spores of a dandelion that just go everywhere. So to make things a little tougher still for an adversary that's active and watching on the network, at each of those points along the stem of the dandelion, as it were, what a node does is before they pass it along to the next node, they combine this transaction with any other transactions they see. So this transaction consolidation process happens even before the point of the miner assembling the block. Every step along that way in the dandelion protocol, these nodes are aggregating transactions to make it more difficult to correlate inputs and outputs. So that's pretty much it for the introduction to Mimblewimble. Tune into the next episode where I continue and discuss a couple topics I left out of this in the context of GRIN and Beam, the two major implementations of this protocol. These are both working blockchains and take very different approaches to things, so be sure not to miss that. Until then, this is Might Be Mike for Hacker Public Radio. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.